Food is fuel for your body, your mind, and definitely your sport. But let's face it, nutrition is confusing, and the expectations on girls and women to be thin and have a six-pack are exhausting. If you've ever been frustrated with your body, confused about nutrition, obsessed with eating healthy, or guilty when you don't, underate, overate, or overtrained, and overwhelmed with all the pressure, then this podcast is for you. Nutrition can be easy. You can take control of it, but it might start with letting go of control by asking for help and making a change. I'm Lindsay Elizabeth Cortez, sports dietitian and owner of Rise Up Nutrition, where I empower female athletes to overcome nutrition concerns and perform at their highest level, to stop being confused by all the mixed or harmful messages, and finally have confidence in your body as a fierce, fit, and fueled female athlete. Hey listeners, Lindsay Elizabeth Cortez, registered dietitian, owner of Rise Up Nutrition, and your host of this podcast. I have a guest with us today. She's a fellow registered sports dietitian who is also a professor and does research and specializes in low energy availability and kind of disordered eating and red S risk. And so we're going to talk all about that today. And she actually started, as you'll learn as we get into the conversation, she started her career doing research on recovery, and she did her dissertation on chocolate milk. And because of that, I wanted to share with you a discount and coupon, I suppose, that we have for you as listeners. Now, look, there's tons of amazing chocolate milks out there. You can get local chocolate milk, you can get grass-fed, you can get just so many different types, right? But as a busy athlete, sometimes you need something that doesn't need to be refrigerated, something that you can throw in your bag, be it your gym bag or your backpack, and have it readily available for post-workout. So that's actually one of the reasons that I very often recommend Orgain as a brand. They have a bunch of different nutritional drinks, powders, and bars, but I really love their nutritional shakes that they have. They have protein shakes, but I love their nutrition shakes, which have protein and carbohydrates and fats in there and really make a wonderful complete recovery option. And again, it is non-perishable. So of course it tastes good cold and in your refrigerator, but it's something that doesn't need to be refrigerated. So you can just bring it with you to practice, or if you're hitting the trails to go for a run or hitting the gym, bring it with you in your bag so that right when you finish your workout, you can have this as a form of recovery. There are different flavor options. We have whey-based nutritional shakes and plant-based nutritional shakes, and you can find Orgain at couple stores in person, but if you purchase online, you can simply use the code RISEUP30 and get 30% off your first online order. So I would strongly encourage you to, you know, give those nutrition shakes a shot for recovery and post-workout. It's a very similar concept to the chocolate milk idea that we're going to chat about with my guest today. And if not Orgain's nutritional shakes, you might want to use this discount, RISEUP30, for 30% off on any of their other products, their protein powders or their bars, and see if it helps you in your fueling journey. So again, that's Orgain.com, O-R-G-A-I-N, and the discount code is RISEUP30. Let's get to our conversation with Kelly now. Okay, fans, my guest today is Kelly Pritchett. She's a professor in nutrition and exercise science at Central Washington University. As a board-certified specialist in sports dietetics, she has consulted with both elite and collegiate athletes, as well as with active individuals. Kelly has a consulting business, Tri-Dimensional Consulting, and works with Wahoo Running and Free Trail, where she provides nutrition education and coaching for predominantly female runners, trail runners, and triathletes. Kelly served as a national media spokesperson for the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics for 6 years and has authored multiple pieces for Runner's World and Bicycling Magazine on topics related to nutrition for female athletes. As a former collegiate swimmer for the University of Alabama swimming and diving team, she understands the challenges that female athletes face. In her spare time, she enjoys running and spending time with her three active boys. Kelly, I'm always excited to have other, I think, like-minded individuals as far as we're both sports dietitians and a passion for female athletes. So I'm very excited to have you on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me, Lindsay. I'm excited to talk to you today.
Yeah. So I always just like to ask of people's personal athletic background, and you yourself were a Division I swimmer at a large and impressive university. Was swimming kind of your childhood passion, or something you always did? Were you a multi-sport athlete in your younger years?
Yeah, my mom, I think, put us in swimming. I have a brother and a sister, but we started probably at the age of five. And so we laughed that she probably like threw us in the pool and told us to go from there. But no, I played soccer and volleyball and softball, but eventually decided to focus just on swimming when I was in high school.
Yeah.
So yeah, tried a lot of different sports, and swimming is definitely my first love.
Yeah. And then when you were competing at the collegiate level at the University of Alabama, were you also studying nutrition at that time?
Yeah, I started off as a chemistry major, actually. Okay. And then we had a dietitian, I think it was a campus wellness dietitian, come and talk to us. And I was kind of intrigued by nutrition during that talk. And after that one talk, I don't think we ever saw a dietitian again. And so that kind of led to my interest in, you know, just mistakes that you make as an athlete and what could I do better to improve my performance from a nutrition standpoint.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, fast forwarding to 2023, we know that the University of Alabama has dietitians to support their athletes now, but back when you were there, they did not. And there's frankly still the majority of collegiate athletes don't have a sports dietitian or an athletic dietitian. They might have like a campus-wide one, but I think you and I would agree they're kind of different what a campus dietitian might do and a sports dietitian. They can both be helpful, but they're just different, right?
Yeah, totally. You know, I think it's definitely an exciting time. If we look at the number of collegiate dietitians now compared to what, you know, we had 20 years ago. And so I think, like you said, you know, most Division I programs do have at least one full-time sports RD, but I teach at like the Division II level. And I know that it's definitely lacking in Division II or Division III programs.
Yeah. And actually, just to get a quick understanding of your current position. So because you're a professor at Central Washington University, but they have athletics there as well.
Mm-hmm.
So do you help out consulting with the athletics, or do they have a different sports dietitian do that?
So I've helped out when I first got here in 2008, I think I started getting requests to see athletes, and it just became like, oh my gosh, I can't handle this. And
there's two separate jobs, being a professor and being a dietitian are two separate jobs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, is an entry level, like we're first starting out, we do a lot of these things out of the goodness of our heart because we love it. And but, you know, I quickly realized like I can't do both of these things. So we worked hard to get a GA position in athletics funded. And so that helped reduce, you know, the load and
absolutely.
And I think we were one of the first Division II programs to have a GA in sports nutrition.
That's great. And just in case somebody's removed from academia, a GA is a graduate assistant. So somebody who's studying, getting their graduate degree in nutrition, but they're getting paid to like work that job to help out the athletes.
Yes. Yeah. They get their tuition covered, and then they typically get a stipend each month.
Yeah. Super helpful. When I was in grad school, I was a TA, so a teaching assistant. So I got to teach like an undergrad course. It was so helpful from a financial perspective, but also incredibly helpful for my learning. Like when you're expected to teach other people, you've got to be on your game as far as your own knowledge goes. So it's so helpful.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah. So going back to, you know, I guess the inception of your career, you were chemistry, you had a talk with a campus dietitian, you were an athlete yourself, and that kind of sparked your interest to start studying nutrition. And I'm just curious, because you mentioned like, you know, there were maybe some pitfalls, some mistakes of your own. What were some of the struggles that you faced as a collegiate swimmer when it comes to fueling and nutrition?
Definitely under fueling. I think the volume of training when I moved from high school to collegiate like doubled. As a high school athlete, I was maybe doing two-a-days like twice a week. And then we went to doing two-a-days almost every day except for Saturday. So it became just a really big change in exercise energy expenditure. And so I really had no idea in terms of fueling what I needed to be doing. And I think I lost my menstrual cycle my sophomore year and then had a calcaneal stress fracture. So yeah, just knowledge wise, I think this was like an unintentional underfueling situation, but no one recognized it either. So,
and yeah, and it's so, you know, this is why I love the term underfueling. I mean, I don't love it. It's not a good thing, but I like the term underfueling because it embodies all the situations where it's unintentional. I think a lot of people can understand, well, a lot of people don't understand it, but let me rephrase this, that there's that like intentional restriction or just even if it's not like intentional from a place of like a disorder, but still a like, I want to eat clean with air quotes around it,
right?
Where there's like people are trying to cut down their diet and restrict, but there's also that I'm not trying to do that at all. I just had a lack of knowledge on how much my body needed. And, or maybe I kept eating the same as I always was, but my training doubled and I, and, and with training doubling, you run out of time too. So it's like, it's not like you have time to eat. And that's a huge thing that happens once your training increases, you run out of time to eat. And that's where underfueling can happen again.
Yeah, you're totally right. I mean, I remember getting out of the pool at like 7:30 for an 8 o'clock class. And, you know, did I grab breakfast on the way? I don't know if I did, but you know, just those sort of things where you're used to your parents making meals and all of a sudden you're put in this collegiate environment where no one's making meals for you. Maybe you're on a meal plan, but yeah, it's just, it's different.
Yeah, for sure. So as you became a dietitian, did you know that you always wanted to specialize in kind of this concept of low energy availability or in female athletes? Because that is something you do specialize in now. Was that always your passion or just something that kind of gradually happened?
I remember as a PhD student, when I was, you know, trying to decide on my dissertation topic, I was really interested in the female athlete triad and, you know, kind of went around in circles in terms of like trying to find a mentor that I was in kinesiology. Long story short, I ended up changing my topic and focusing on recovery.
Oh, yeah, I read that
there was
somewhere
a
about
chocolate
you
milk
online.
Study.
Yeah, recovery. And I thought to myself, I didn't know she focused on that. Okay.
Yep. Okay. So recovery for quite a while, and is still a passion of mine, but the chocolate milk studies were my dissertation work.
Okay, can we pause and talk about that then? Because
for sure.
It is just like such, and I fall right into the category of your classic sports dietitian that's like drink chocolate milk post-workout. It's just like, it's just what we say. And one, it's delicious. Two, we know it's got protein in it. And we say chocolate milk because it's got those extra carbohydrates. But I don't know, could you expand upon that with your dissertation? Like, what is it about chocolate milk or why that works or why it's needed for recovery and in what situations?
Yeah, I think when we talk about chocolate milk as being the ideal recovery beverage, it's, I think it takes a lot of the guesswork out for athletes. You know, we can throw numbers at them all day in terms of like, this is how much carbs you need, this is how much protein you need, and you need fluids. Oh, and these vitamins and minerals are good for you as well. But I think if you look at chocolate milk, you know, it contains an ideal amount of carbohydrate along with protein, fluids, sodium, calcium. So I just think, you know, it's something easy too. And if we don't really have an appetite after training too, I feel like it's something that's easy to get down for a lot of athletes. In terms of when is it crucial though, I think, you know, two-a-day workouts, athletes who are maybe training for longer than 90 minutes, then recovery really does, you know, become important. So if you're a college student going to the gym and going to spinning class is not as crucial. I still think recovery nutrition is a good idea, but you don't necessarily have to meet those marks in terms of, you know, the carbohydrate amount and the protein amount.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think even That brings up a good point of like, where do you draw the line of like, was my workout hard enough for a certain recovery thing or not? But I think you kind of did mention like, it's not going to hurt. It won't hurt you. Right. So I think
if you are
training with a purpose, like go ahead and try recovery and see how that makes you feel, see how that affects you the rest of your day. And then we do know for sure, like, okay, if you are like, a high school three sport athlete, go. Or a collegiate athlete of any level. And then post college and in our adult lives, you just as an example, you just did the Chicago Marathon, like you're training regularly, I'm currently in a different life stage myself. So I'm not like I'm exercising, but I wouldn't say I'm training. Right. It's like you kind of have to just like reevaluate.
Right.
As you move on. But yeah, it's like it doesn't hurt. So even just as an example, I'm just exercising right now. I, for the most part, still grab a milk before I hit the shower because it's like it tastes good. It hydrates me and it starts my recovery. And then I'm going to have breakfast once I'm done with my shower and like finish fueling and finish that recovery. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
definitely. And I think, too, as women with, as we get older, bone health is important, too. And so it definitely can't hurt.
Yeah. It doesn't hurt. It doesn't hurt at all. And it has the potential to help. So, Well, amazing. And then, so recovery was where you started, but then you've moved on since that. And yeah, you started focusing on the female athlete triad. And I'm sure throughout your career is as like information about Red S has come out. So probably when you started researching and working as a dietitian, we were mostly focusing on female athlete triad, which is still a thing and still exists. But we've kind of expanded upon that with some research and started diving into the concept of relative energy deficiency in sport and low energy availability. We almost have like new terminology for all of this, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. But I think maybe a fun part to this episode here would be if you kind of just gave us a little rundown of some of your recent research. I want to start with one that you completed and you just correct me if I'm wrong, Kelly, about like, who's like the primary investigator of the research and things like that. But we had Keely Henninger on this podcast in episode number 85. And so I wanted to bring her up because you and her worked together for some research on exercise dependency. And I just wanted to give you a moment to maybe chat about some of that.
Yeah. So the most recent study that was just accepted for publication, I conducted alongside with Keely Henninger, who is a professional trail runner. And when I first started working with her on this project, I think she was still working for Nike as an independent scientist.
Yeah.
And I had shared, I think on Instagram, another study with recreational runners, and she shared the graphic and the QR code. And so I don't remember what happened next, but we started talking about research. And so it was pretty cool because she was, I shared it with a few like prominent runners, but she was one of the ones that did share it. And so that's where this idea kind of evolved to look at trail running, and trail running being a relatively new sport. There hasn't been a lot of research conducted on it.
Yeah, absolutely. And in it was, I think, the focus was on exercise dependency, right? To see, because in the trail running community, some of those races get like really, really long. I mean, 100-mile races, 200-mile races. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those things of like, okay, this is a sport and we're competing, but is this overlapping with some level of like exercise addiction or exercise dependency? Mm-hmm. Could you share about some of the, like generally speaking, some of the results that were found? Was there a big overlap?
Yeah, so we wanted to look at risk of low energy availability and risk of disordered eating and risk of exercise dependence in this population, as well as fueling strategies, which I could also share. But we found that about 43% of runners were at risk for low energy availability, and that 87% reported symptoms related to exercise dependence. So yeah, we did find that, that they seem to be interrelated. And another thing is that those female athletes who are at risk for low energy availability, they were less likely to meet the fueling recommendations during training and racing than those not at risk for low energy availability.
43% of these trail runners mm-hmm. were at risk of low energy availability. I feel like that percentage is very much in line with what I've seen across a multitude of other studies, mm-hmm. like low energy availability in collegiate athletes or in really, frankly, other sports or in a female population yep. specifically. Like, it always falls around that 40 mark. That's like, it's almost 50%, but maybe not quite.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. To your point that it's a pretty high, from a training standpoint, a very high volume sport yeah. too. So
it's kind of easy with such a high yeah, volume right. of training. Mm-hmm. It's unfortunately, I think, easy to be in that low energy availability category because you're just frankly burning through so much. Yeah. It's hard to keep up with.
Yeah. And then when you, mm-hmm. and if they're not meeting, you know, fueling needs during training and racing. So we kind of broke that up into looking at their runs that were 1 to 2.5 hours in duration and whether or not they met the 30 to 60 grams of carbohydrate per hour recommendation. And then 2.5 hours, the recommendations changed to 60 grams of carbohydrate per hour. And so we did find at that 2.5 hour mark that the majority are not meeting those recommendations. And so, you know, that kind of has spurred some other research ideas in terms of like, what are the barriers? Is it GI related? Are they able to, you know, is just getting that amount of calories in? What's the barrier?
Yeah. Yeah. I think GI, appetite, taste preference, just like mm-hmm. physical exhaustion at that point, you just don't want to eat sometimes.
Right.
Yeah. Or yes. potentially even being so focused on like finishing that you don't want the distraction of mm-hmm. eating potentially. I don't yeah. know. Yeah, that'll be other areas of research to tap into. I did want to bring up something else. And this is, I know, not like your primary research, but mm-hmm. something, I think it was just published this past March. It was looking at examination of cumulative risk assessment and nutritional profiles among collegiate ballet dancers. I know you are not the primary author on this. But you were part of that mm-hmm. somehow. Yep. Okay. And then what I found interesting though is that they looked at low energy availability as well in these collegiate ballet dancers and found that in a dietary assessment, 96% of the ballet dancers were low in carbohydrates, 92% low in protein, 19% were low in fat. All 100% of ballet dancers were low in vitamin D. 96% were low in calcium. Those are incredibly high numbers. But we were just sharing, you know, that kind of sometimes
yeah.
low energy intake is around that 40% mark. And in that study, collegiate ballet dancers, I mean,
yeah,
that was shocking to me.
Right. I think it's, you know, a few things. That particular study was conducted using 7-day diet records. And so I think it's really important to differentiate in some of these studies where, you know, like using the LEAF cue, that's an assessment tool. We're trying to assess risk of low energy availability versus, you know, like a food record, a 7-day food record. And mm-hmm. I'm not saying one is better than the other, but I just think it's important to note, like, calculating energy availability in athletes is a very difficult thing to do. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't doubt that these ballet dancers, you know, definitely had some areas they could work on, but it is crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. A great differentiation of here's a calculation of like grams and energy mm-hmm. availability versus what is somebody reporting that they're logging that they're eating. And
right.
In my experience as a dietitian, I'd love to hear yours, but in my experience, nobody logs correctly.
No.
And it goes both ways. We have a lot of the population mm-hmm. that underreports.
Yep.
Because they forgot what they ate. They're not good at estimating portion sizes. They, you know, just forgot, I think is really it. We eat and forgot that we, oh, I grabbed that snack here. Oh yeah, I did add a sauce on top. Yeah. Like we just like forgot. Mm-hmm. But I've also seen in my experience the opposite. And this is more in the realm of disordered eating and disordered mindset approach to food. I've seen many people mm-hmm. who always round up, and it is a disordered mindset of trying to convince themselves that they've eaten enough or too much and therefore should stop. This is very dangerous mm-hmm. and disordered, but like I've seen that too. Like, and I know that if anybody comes work with me, I'm going to see right through,
your lies. I mean, yeah. And anytime you're being watched or you feel like you're being watched, I feel like we change our habits. So, you know, so there's, I love, you know, this data is so important and this research is so important, but I still think it's like fraught with errors, as you've just kind of brought up. But yeah. So, you know, in the new REDS paper that has come out, they really do acknowledge some of the difficulties too, and that a calculated LEA might not be the best way to go in terms of, you know, performing an assessment. And so using something like the LEAF cue mm-hmm. can actually be a good start for practitioners.
Could you expand upon that for any new or up and coming practitioners or dietitians that might be listening to this right now? Can you explain what the LEAF cue is?
Yeah. So the LEAF cue is the low energy availability in female athlete questionnaire. And it looks at a few different domains. It looks at injuries. It looks at GI disturbances. It looks at menstrual health. And so it can actually be used to determine menstrual dysfunction. But it's been clinically validated against low energy availability. So has a high sensitivity and specificity. So, it can be used, I feel like, as an assessment tool in practice for dietitians versus trying to actually calculate energy availability yourself. Yeah. You need access to a DEXA to get fat-free mass. I mean, things like that that are just not practical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I find in my practice, especially since it's all virtual, I'm using a variety of things and just kind of like combining them all, which is not mm-hmm. scientifically validated to just like combine all of them. But it's, you know, it's, I'm using questionnaires, I'm using LEAF cue, I'm using like mm-hmm. the EAT26, I'm using, mm-hmm. there's like a questionnaire for orthorexia, I'm using energy availability calculations, I'm using Mifflin St. George equations, like I use them all, I literally use them all, and then I like make my best educated guess. And this is why it's so important to know your clients too. Like this type of work, this is why when people themselves just go online and try and plug in their height and weight and like pop out some calculation for them, like it just doesn't work, because we have to look beyond the numbers. We have to look at symptoms. We have to look at your training. We have to look at your history and like mm-hmm. put it all together. And I think that's where the LEAF cue, as you just mentioned, is great, because it's looking at those symptoms a little bit more mm-hmm. than just numbers.
Yeah, exactly. It's so individualized in terms of knowing, well, I need to do this with this athlete, and maybe I need to do this with another athlete. It could just be a conversation, like you've mentioned, and looking at some of those signs and symptoms of underfueling. Mm-hmm. Are you recovering? Is your performance, do you feel like you're adapting to the training? Are you irritable? Those sort of things that I feel like could be red flags too.
Absolutely. So you had some other research recently on collegiate and recreational runners. Would you be willing mm-hmm. to share with us kind of what was the intent or purpose of this research, and what were some of those findings in the, maybe some differences in the collegiate population versus the recreational population when it comes to the sport of running?
So yeah, those two studies, I had two grad students that conducted those studies last year. It was a survey-based study too, similar to the Trail Runner paper, where we use the LEAF cue to assess low energy availability risk. And we use the DESA-6, which is the disordered eating and screening tool for athletes. It's got 6 questions. So we did use that because it was relatively shorter, and it is noted in the new REDS consensus paper as being a tool that would be acceptable to use. But we did find similar numbers in the recreational runners, around that sort of 40-45%.
Yeah.
And similar in the collegiate runners too. And so one thing we did compare with the, we wanted to look at Division 1, 2, and 3. and see if there were any differences there. We noted no differences. One thing retrospectively I wish we would have asked in the collegiate study is about access to a dietitian or any, had they had previous education, those types of things. So I think that might be interesting to look at. Although I think you would probably agree with me that you can have all the knowledge in the world, but it might not change your behavior. So that's a direction that I think would be interesting to take with research next as well.
Absolutely. So such a good point about, or interesting insight that, you know, low energy availability and Red S was pretty similar numbers between the collegiate athletes and the recreational athletes. Going back to our conversation about recovery and chocolate milk, there's so many times when people can doubt themselves. Oh, I'm not an athlete, you know? Yeah. And it's like, yeah, you are. You're going out on a run. The average person doesn't just run for fun.
Exactly.
Like, give yourself credit. Start treating yourself like an athlete, because otherwise you're going to fall right into that same category. Oh my goodness. Mm-hmm. I know, Kelly, you'll appreciate this because you have children. You're a boy mom. I'm a boy mom of two. Two. And we're reading that book. Oh my goodness. One fish, two fish, red fish, blue fish, right?
Yeah.
And there's a page, I crack up every time there's a page in there about, it's about all the different types of people and funny things. And it's like, here, look at these things. They like to run. They run for fun in the hot, hot sun. What a funny thing they do. And anyways, this is Dr. Seuss. But every time I go to that page, I'm like, I'm like, that is funny that these things just run in the hot sun for fun. And,
who would do that?
Who would do that? Us crazy runner. Right. So to the recreational athlete of any sport, to the recreational runner, like, treat yourself like an athlete, because that's not, it is, that's not.
Yeah.
I don't want to say it's not normal, but like, give yourself credit for what you are doing is what I want to say. Give yourself credit for the physical activity that you are doing.
Exactly. And that's one of the reasons, you know, we wanted to look at that population, is because I do think, you know, they're maybe often overlooked, like you said, and they could easily be doing similar training volumes to collegiate runners. I mean, just because they're recreational, it doesn't necessarily define the training volume too. And a lot of them may get into it for weight loss purposes too. Yeah,
and that's the danger of low energy availability as well. If they got into it for weight loss purposes, maybe they weren't eating enough to begin with too.
Yep.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You know, and I know that study was still done in a similar like age category, but we think about, well, post-college, the majority of people, especially in the sport of running, like, it is recreational, you know. I run, you run, and we're competitive, but like, we're still doing it just for fun at the end of the day, you know?
100%.
Yeah. But I know you recently completed the Chicago Marathon. It's like, no, that's a huge undertaking. That's months of training. The day itself is huge. It's a huge undertaking. Like, just because it was recreational doesn't take away the fueling requirements of that.
Yep. Yeah, I know. And it's, you know, I tell my athletes oftentimes, you know, I'm out there for 5 hours. They'll ask, do I need to fuel as much as someone running a 3 hour marathon? Well, yes, you do. I mean, if anything, it becomes more important. So
just they're 2 hours longer. You're not
as, right. You're not as fast as person X. That doesn't mean your needs are any less. Mm-hmm. So I think there's maybe a misconception there as well.
I know, speaking specifically to the sport of running too, actually, some runners that may take longer, you actually do have other challenges. Like, if the race started early in the morning and it was cool, but now you're on the course longer, it's like, is it getting hot now? You've lost more fluid, more electrolytes. Like, the other runners that finish have already had a meal. Like, you haven't had a meal yet. Like, there's, and I say that from a place of like compassion, that you actually do need to validate how much effort this is for you and your nutrition requirements.
Yeah, I think you're right. If anything, it's more impressive in my opinion. Yeah, just, you know, they're out there a lot longer and there's a lot more variables, definitely.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay, there was one other thing that I just feel like, I know this isn't a primary study of yours, but, and it's 2021 that it was published, so it's older, but I just thought it was really interesting. This was energy balance and eating disorder risk behavior among athletic trainers. And the reason I wanted to bring this up is because we're having that conversation about athletes and then like recreational. And then these are people who support athletes, not even necessarily,
right,
you know, the person in the game or competition itself. Mm-hmm. But this study actually did find that athletic trainers, it was a small study, that it was a really small sample size.
Yeah.
Really small sample size. But still, 84% had eating disorder risk.
Right.
Oh, my goodness. So it's kind of almost, yeah. I think that kind of just contributes to the idea of we're in and surrounded by sports, that in this profession of athletic trainers, maybe there's other like caretakers, people are on their feet a lot. Mm. I see this a lot with like, I don't know, like physical therapists or nurses who are like on their feet caring for other people all day and like not taking care of themselves.
Yeah, exactly. So this study was conducted along with Tony Torres McGee, who is one of my colleagues, but I have done a lot of work with her and some of her students. So she is an athletic trainer. And I think this idea evolved in the fact that like athletic trainers have really busy schedules in terms of the hours that they put in. And so I think that's just one of the things that was really noted is that, you know, they don't take time to sit down and have a meal, or so taking care of their, you know, health and diet. Really, we should do some things to, you know, improve our efforts there.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's supporting the athlete and the people who support that athlete as well.
Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Kelly, do you have any, are you or any of your students currently working on research that you're really jazzed about and excited about that you'd like to share? Or do you have any, I know so much with research, sometimes you're looking for participants or you have online studies, like online questionnaires that you're blasting out, anything like that?
Yeah, I have a student next year. We're going to use the REDS CAT 2 tool, which is a new assessment tool that's just come out. And we're going to focus on volleyball, our ball sports. So volleyball, rugby, basketball, and soccer, which are, I would say, sports that are, you know, kind of overlooked in this area of research. And we're going to do DEXAs and leaf cues and EDEQs, which are, you know, all included as part of the REDS CAT 2 assessment tool.
Yeah, I think that's so important. I had a group call with my clients last night, and we were presenting some research that was on runners. And I actually paused and shared with my clients. I was like, look, not all of you are runners here, but problem is, it's almost like sports like running, swimming, biking, cycling, like it's honestly just easier to conduct research on that population because it's like easier to just like run a 5K, run a 10K, and like there's a start and an end. But it's like, oh, there's a 2-hour soccer practice or, you know, a 60-minute volleyball match. And it's like you can't control for everything happening during that. It's like how much did you run versus how much did the game stop with the whistles blowing and like your position that you were playing? How much time did you actually exert and effort? So it's a lot harder, I think, to do when it comes to the physical component to do research on those stop and go sports or those ball sports. We need it because, you know, it's like, okay, well, in soccer, you know, they are running. So it's helpful to have the running research because we can translate it a little bit, but it's not quite the same.
Right. Right. Yeah, exactly. And I think we know those are all high intensity sports. So they do come with the high energy demand. But like you mentioned, it's so variable from probably position to position, sport to sport versus, you know, capturing the energy cost of running. We can put someone on a treadmill and do that easily. But
yeah,
you know, we're curious. I've done a study before with volleyball. This was like 2012, where I think we looked at eating disorder risk and some of their fueling habits. And so even though it's not a ball sport, I do think that, you know, volleyball has been flagged as being one of those sports that's at risk. If you think about, we could talk about this all day, but the clothing differences too, and the uniforms that some of these sports are wearing. and how that's changed over the years and how that might contribute as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think, you know, nobody's at risk of underfueling red S nobody is immune to underfueling or red S, but there certainly are some pockets of sports or people that might be at a higher risk just with kind of the demand of that sport or the environment that they're in. And I've seen that too in my experience as well with volleyball.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Kelly, this was just a fun conversation, I think insightful, and I love sharing statistics, a little bit more of that like science angle, and, you know, just sharing your journey. And it's so great that we're continuing to push for research in those pockets that we're like, oh, this, we don't have this yet in, you know, in these ball sports and stuff. So we need to figure that out. So thank you for all the work that you do and continuing to get more answers, because with answers, we can get better support and resources.
Of course. Thank you for inviting me on the show.
Yeah. And before you leave, I do have a few more questions that are a little more fun. Well, I think it's been fun the whole time, but here's a few more fun questions. Kelly, if there's one food you could eat every single day for the rest of your life and never be sick of it, what would it be?
Oh, gosh. I'm going to say probably peanut butter.
Yeah. Peanut butter lovers all across the world are just rejoicing with you. What is your favorite sport to participate in?
Oh, that is running right now. I still love swimming, but.
Do you still running. Swim? Do you still get yourself to the pool, or more of a pastime?
You know, I swam when I was pregnant and it felt amazing. Right now, my husband and I fight over who gets to go. And so currently, because we have a master's group here. So currently, he's the one that's going to those practices. And he was actually a runner in college. So I feel like we've kind of
switched. You flip-flopped. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, that's signs of a working partnership to, you know, work together, what works for the family, take your turns. Love that. So running is your current favorite. How about as a spectator? What is your favorite sport to watch and cheer on?
Well, I did go to the University of Alabama, so it has to be football, I suppose.
Yeah, that's a huge and successful team there, so. I understand that. College football lover. Okay. And then last question. If there's a female athlete out there that you want to give a shout out to for being a role model or an inspiration for any reason, and this could be somebody in your personal life or somebody well-known, who would that be?
Oh, I have to say, I have to give Keely a shout out, because I do think she's, you know, making a difference in the running world and really trying to change the conversation.
Yeah. And as somebody who's connected with Keely personally as well, I definitely agree, you know, that she's a role model as being an athlete, but going one step further of trying to promote, you know, research for female athletes and appropriate fueling and nutrition. And so that's awesome.
Yep.
Great, Kelly. Well, thank you again. This was fun.
Thank you so much.
Well, everybody, thanks for listening. I really hope you enjoyed that episode. And if you did, if you are a true fan of female athlete nutrition, then I would love if you could support our podcast by spreading the word. Share a review on your listening channel. Give us 5 stars. It really helps get the word out and get the show more views to positively impact others. Also, you can support the podcast by joining our Patreon. Head to patreon.com/femaleathletenutrition to consider a donation, or even better, join our membership where you get extra monthly content and perks. We don't want you to simply listen alone. We want you to be a part of a community and a movement of fierce, fit, and fueled female athletes. So patreon.com/femaleathletenutrition is where you can do exactly that, learn more, and join. A huge thanks to our affiliates and partners as well. Once again, Prevenix, Inside Tracker, Orgain, Practice Better, Jen and Carrie, please go check them out, and their links in the show notes where you can get deals and discounts. Last, be sure that you do more than just listen. If you need help with fueling, it's time to take action. Head to my website to learn more. You can either book a free call with me to learn more about our coaching programs and how we can work directly with you, whether it's the fast track or otherwise, Or you can take our online self-study course, Female Athlete Nutrition. You can literally sign up and gain access right now. You can explore our downloadable products, including the Red S Recovery Guide, High Iron Fueling Guide. Or if you are a coach of a team, check out our brand new Coaches Toolkit for teams. You can also just learn more. We have a blog, a Red S quiz to see if Red S is affecting you. If you need help, I want you to get help fast. Too many girls and athletes struggle with nutrition, but you don't have to any longer. You can rise up with the power of nutrition, take action today in any of these avenues, and become fierce, fit, and fueled. Links in the show notes, and we'll see you next time.